Okay. So I'm going to quickly talk about the environment and its impact on health, how design does make a difference for the environment's well-being and health, as well as human health. And then I'll mention briefly an awards program that's actually with many different supporters from federal government and other aging and public health groups called Building Healthy Communities for Active Aging. And then talk a little bit about the federal effort called Sustainable Communities between DOT, HUD, and EPA. And I should say HHS is there because we work closely with CDC all the time. Okay, first, the environmental impacts from how we build has a huge impact on air quality. It's actually responsible, the building and transportation sectors together are responsible for two-thirds of all greenhouse gas emissions. From a water quality standpoint, when we build compactly, it makes a huge difference, a 50% difference in the stormwater runoff when we've got more impervious surface to deal with. And actually, EPA also estimates that 70% of urban water bodies are impaired because of how we develop. And finally, there's a loss in habitat in crucial areas, the ecosystem problem, where almost 80% of all the species that are listed on the Endangered Species Act, the main reason that threatens them has been how we've developed. And I'll stop and pose, just give you a visual about, is it sprawl a term that everybody's heard of? Okay. And if you think of, I love this visual, if you had kids to even teach your grandkids about sprawl. I had a pitcher of water here, and you can just imagine a tin, a big tub for dishes. And you would pour this in. The water would go everywhere, right? And that's kind of how we've been building. And if you had one cup, you could concentrate all of the building right there. Or if you're in a rural area and you had centers of activity, you could also concentrate, develop it, and then leave the land protected. So that's sort of a visual on sprawl. And that makes a difference for those three things I just mentioned, as well as human health. Water quality, roads and parking lots, you know, I'm sure you know the Big Yellow Taxi song, you know, they paved paradise and put up a parking lot. And they really are responsible for an awful lot of the increased contamination in our wastewater that goes into our sewers, and sometimes when we have really bad floods, which will be more severe and more common with climate change, more that ends up in our basement and becomes a public health issue from interaction with that. Okay. Why am I having trouble again? Okay. Didn't do it. Sorry. I'm sorry. Okay, so what is climate change? It's different between the weather, which is day-to-day, versus patterns over long period of times. And so this extension of period is really what we're talking about when we're talking about climate change. And the people who are most at risk are sort of the people who are most vulnerable already. But it's, from a worldwide standpoint, it's the poor countries, it's the people who are in urban settings, in traditional societies, subsistence farmers, and people who live by the coasts. But again, the International Panel on Climate Change said, again, if you look at who are the most vulnerable, it's really the young and the old and the poor. And what climate change is really going to do is just really accentuate the existing disparities that are already in existence now. So this is just one more layer, one more burden that's going to be happening. It also, the IPCC has predicted, too, that just looking at one aspect, extreme heat events, that they're going to be more frequent, they're going to last longer, going to be more severe because of the heat island, how we're building again. Urbanization that's happening worldwide, more people moving to the city centers and mega city development. There's also the trend of course, worldwide trend of the U.S. population and the world population aging. And there's many more people worldwide and in the United States living alone, which is another risk factor for extreme heat events. And here's a little diagram, which you can see the top line is the day temperatures, so they get more extreme. And then you see the night temperatures in blue that are cooler. And you'll notice, if you live in a rural area, you might have big differences night and day in temperatures. You see that big gap? But you see what happens in urban areas? The little dotted lines, they're almost identical. So it doesn't really cool down at night. And that's, again, because the absorption of cement, you know, contains the heat versus the green that, you know, dissipates it. So it really cools down. You can think about if you ever go on vacation or something away from your cities, how it's cooler at night. You say, wow, I need a jacket. So this is again, a worldwide trend. So now quickly, again, talking about how design affects climate change and human health, how we develop, again, will have impact on our transportation options and alternatives. Do we have the only way to get around by car? Do we have options, safe streets, complete streets for biking, for walking? Do we have public transportation? How closely are homes packed together? Or do we have activity centers in rural areas where we concentrate lots of development, where stores are, where people are living? We have something called mixed land use. Before World War II, we used to build schools. We used to build where we worked near the neighborhoods where we lived. And then after World War II, we sort of had this idea of separating things into the suburbs, and we had isolated one-purpose use for things. We had housing here, we had retail there, we had schools way out, we had, you know, senior centers, maybe not in the right place, but in a green field that was supposed to be nicer, that becomes then a challenge to get around the mobility issue. And then parks and green space, and some communities do a really good job of having multiple ways to get to parks. That's a public entity for people of all incomes. You don't have to join a gym to be able to use your parks and green space to be outside. So this is, I would say, an environmental justice issue. And then, of course, we have to look at the kinds of buildings and the materials what we're using for homes, and whether we're using water, low-level toilets, and also the lighting and so forth. So energy-efficient buildings. You can also look at community design affecting, you know, sort of nine issues. So if you think about the land, it really can have an impact how we develop on the rates of obesity. There's been many studies that have been done, and I'll do a plug for the session after this one with our panel for the Healthy Communities for Healthy Aging Forum, where we're going to have Larry Frank talk about obesity and transportation linkages, physical activity, clearly, cardiovascular disease. Again, all of these are related to, the silver bullet of physical activity being incorporated into our daily lives based on how we build our communities. And again, the water quality and quantity. We're out in the West here where quantity is an issue. Related, again, how we build communities, the transportation and how we're auto-dependent has an impact immediately. And the Lancet did a series with NIEHS last year that talked about what they called the health dividend immediately by reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It's not just for now. I mean, I should say it's not just for the future. It's for now. You know, people who live near highways or people who spend more time in cars, you know, there's also a relationship to having, you know, a lot of health problems when people have underlying cardiovascular disease, COPD and asthma. This is a contributor to climate change. So it's actually, if we can find alternative ways of getting around for short trips, we can actually reduce, we can mitigate greenhouse gas emissions and also improve health. So it's, in other words, the health dividend. Obviously, for people worrying about motor vehicle injuries and even pedestrian interactions, you know, do we have complete streets? Do we have sidewalks? Do people have to walk in the road? And finally, I think a really important thing in aging too is there's a social cost when you're in a car and driving without being able to interact with people when you're walking down the streets or seeing friends that can check in on you and so forth. So there's a social capital that can be enhanced based on how we build as well. And again, as I mentioned, the environmental justice when things are for the United States, a study about a fifth of older adults don't even drive. Other people don't even own cars. So this is really a way for people to get around for alternative ways than being dependent just on a car. Okay, so again, most of us drive, and many of us expect to be driving for as long as we're able to. One thing that's really important for when we're maybe not in that car too is, again, how we design the streets. So I'm going to show you some pictures, I hope. And I don't know how many of you guys have heard of the guy named Dan Burden. Okay, there we go. We've got one person, Melissa, who I wanted to plug, who works for Dan Burden now. But Dan Burden came up with this test, which is called the Beatles test. Oh, darn. Can your community pass the Beatles test? Okay. Well, I said that wasn't good enough for the people that I worry about, so I had to improve it and call it the Zimmer's test. And if you see them on YouTube, you can see this group crossing the street. So it's really, this is a pretty good walkway because you can see the sidewalk, right? And you can imagine a lot, even around here, where it's not so safe. Well, I'm not sure if this is ADA compliant. If I were in a wheelchair walking straight ahead, I have an option to go into the street or up the curb into Wendy's here. To keep going, sorry. And here again, we've got ADA compliant. It's just they didn't connect the sidewalk, as you can see again here. I think this is actually Andy Dannenberg, who does health impact assessments, with Dan Burden here with the little visor. But again, they actually do walking audits with people who are in wheelchairs. And if they don't have anyone who is immobile, they have someone. You will be in a wheelchair, Ruth Palumbo, when they do this assessment. And again, this was in Durham, North Carolina. Now, here's a little picture, again, that I think was done by one of my colleagues in the Smart Growth Office. So here's the main link between people and services, okay? And I'll see that little dotted line, okay? As you can see, the guy in the lower half of the picture, one man's walking in the street, if you can see him. Another one, there is a sidewalk on one side, but this is a pretty busy, you know, street. I'm not sure how friendly that is to get to where this person's heading. Now, as you come up to this place, here's a food store where basically it's designed basically to have a car to go pick up your groceries. There's really no sidewalks nearby to get stuff. And here's a man waiting for his bus in the bright sun. And I imagine in North Carolina it's quite hot. And if it were raining, not a really great place to wait for the bus. There is a bench at least. There's a place to sit. But bus shelters can be a really important thing, again, for people who have no choice but the public transportation. And here, again, is a nice ADA-compliant curb that goes nowhere. So, again, you know, so bottom line here is just remember, design does matter, okay? When you're thinking about the people who are coming to your services, whether it be the local health department or to a senior center or to a meal site, you know, how do people get from where they live to where you're doing your services, okay? So, again, I'll just show you a senior center here. It's nationally accredited, okay? I'm not sure what's on the list of accreditation, but they have a very big parking lot, and it's so big that even across the street it says no more parking for you senior center people going. And then, of course, they've got this nice sidewalk and stairs to get up with a wheelchair that I think is, you know, I guess they have to all be, you know, independently mobile. So basically the message is don't walk to this facility. Okay, so, and again, I didn't go into all the benefits of physical activity, but you guys in public health know all of them, from cancer to cardiovascular disease and so forth. So, again, I'll show you a quick rendering of how the heat island is can be affected. This is a not-so-friendly place for bicycles or for pedestrians. With a little bit of paint, looks a lot better. And there it looks like a place I'd actually go out, and you can see, you know, bikes is a friendly place. Now I'll just quickly mention our Building Healthy Communities for Active Aging. I don't know if Marsha Ori is here, but she came to me a number of years ago, and we brought and said, we've got to really take physical activity to the scale of community. You know, we've got all these programming, but we need to build it into our everyday community. So she came to me at EPA, President's Council of Fitness and Sports, National Council on the Aging, the CDC, and Active for Life, funded by Robert Wood Johnson, to come up with an awards program. And basically the goal was that we're going to provide environmental benefits, you know, by, again, how we build sprawl or compact development that would have all the environmental benefits on the left-hand side and all of the physical activity benefits on the right-hand side. We have 41 supporting organizations, many who are leaders in both, you know, leadership in local government as well as in American public health, as well as all the gerontological organizations. So quite a group of people who've been supporting this effort. We've got winners from all over the country, and we're about to announce more next year. And I've got a plug for, in the back of the room, New Partners for Smart Growth meeting that brings together planners, public health people, and environmental people, as well as elected officials. And I'll only mention, too, that I've got one of my grantees in the room, Margaret Neal, from the Portland State University, who is finishing up a grant with us to demonstrate sustainable streets and greenways in a low-income neighborhood in Portland. And in Maine, they have a statewide program called Encore that actually was matched by the Atlantic Philanthropies for another $500,000 matching grant. So it's potentially a $1.1 million to get elders to be involved in local planning decisions and sustainability. We have a guidebook that's put it in simple languages. This is, I think, a meaningful legacy thing for people to get involved with. So we have this available at no cost that you can have. Order on our website, and it really goes through all the smart growth issues and local gardening and so sustainability things that are in plain English and easy to understand. And in summary, the sustainable communities proposal for the federal government are really six goals: to provide more transportation options, to provide more equitable and affordable housing, and you know the connection of housing and transportation, you know, what they call transit-oriented development is really key when the lowest one-fifth of the population over 65 really spend more than 50% of their income on that. Enhancing economic competitiveness for a community when you've got things together. You can actually, you know, bring people to coffee shops that they wouldn't have gotten to before. Obviously, coordinating policies, leveraging investment, and then valuing communities and neighborhoods, which I think is really valuing people. So I just wanted to end with this little quote from John Muir, who is a Scottish man, that when we tug at one single thing in nature, we find that it's attached to the rest of the world. And I think really the environment really is a public health issue, and it's an aging issue. And I thank you. I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Questions?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, actually, they are at the sustainable communities talking about the, you know, the green housing and also the sustainable agriculture. Even in our guidebook, we talk about what they used to call victory gardens and local growing produce. So that's a movement they really are bringing together, because energy and climate change and public health, all those things really deal with the system when you deal with smart growth. Well, I'm happy to try to connect to our USDA people, too. Thank you.